In 2011, my colleague Professor Sean Connolly made me an offer I could not refuse, to write about Belfast history from the Great War to the late 1960s for the collection Belfast 400, People, Place and History. The task was to craft a fresh historical narrative that did not ignore sectarian conflict, whilst introducing other themes central to the city's social history. I took on the task with relish, but quickly recognised large gaps in the literature on issues such as leisure, work, consumption, housing and urban redevelopment in Belfast. I'm quite proud of the chapter in Belfast 400, but it stirred an ambition to write a more comprehensive account of Belfast, its people and their social history. And it's the contention of what I want to say today, that the historical focus on political conflict has left the social history and the oral history of the social history of Belfast poorly understood. As we all know, the island of Ireland is currently midway through the decade of centenaries, marking the Home Rule crisis, the Great War, the Easter Rising, the War of Independence, partition, etc. And the renewed scrutiny of Irish political history, I think, threatens to marginalise further less visible histories. Now, it may seem hackneyed to revamp E.P. Thompson's exhortation, but perhaps it's time to set about the task of rescuing the poor carter, the shop steward at the docks, the obsolete linen doffer, and even the deluded followers of the Save Ulster from Sodomy campaign, from the enormous condescension of posterity. I think we need a history of the families on the corporation housing waiting list in 1955. We need to know what were the ambitions of the young working class woman who was the first in her family to enter higher education and university in the 1960s, a recipient of a grant of the 1947 Education Act, which we've been hearing about already. What do historians know about the taxi driver who drives them to and from the airport on the way to conferences to discuss perhaps Ireland's political history? Was he once a young man with a different future mapped out when serving his time at the ill-fated DeLorean Motor Company, for example? Without answers to these questions, our historical understanding is all the poorer. In particular, a focus of a new form of oral history might be Northern Ireland's experience of deindustrialisation or urban redevelopment, which I think have been submerged in historical understandings by a sea of studies of sectarian violence and political divisions. Arguably, deindustrialisation and urban redevelopment represented Belfast's second troubles, one with a small t, unlike its capitalised brother, the headline hogging power military conflict. Oral history offers one very obvious route to begin tackling these themes. It has the potential to weave a new social history focused on issues such as class, gender, urban redevelopment, deindustrialisation, leisure, crime, that will refresh existing historiographies in each of these areas. Recent advancements in digital technologies give it the ability. Advances in digital technologies give it the ability also to do so in a fashion which potentially democratises the process and advances a new form of people's history also. Having said that, there are obviously going to be significant challenges to be faced, not least the different agendas and desires of academic historians, community groups and their representatives. And I want to explore some of those issues today. What I want to talk about today is provide a brief overview of oral history, how it's been carried out in Northern Ireland, highlight some of the important themes within working class history, in effect, that have been involved in the use of oral history here. But I also want to take a quick case study, one example of Belfast oral history, analysing deindustrialisation and urban redevelopment of the Belfast Docklands. And I want to then finish today's talk by discussing the future developments, and how evolving technologies might move us forward, and open that up to questions both here and maybe in the later sessions today. Okay, so a little bit first about the past of oral history. Perhaps most of us know a lot of this. We know about oral history and its and how it lay at the heart of radical new social histories that were being advocated in the 1960s and the 1970s. new histories of labour, of working class communities, women's histories, race. It was part of a great enthusiasm for radical history, history from below, that fostered developments such as the History Workshop Society and the Oral History Society. Each were influenced by ideas centred on democratising the historical project by giving voice to subaltern groups who were either not heard in official sources or who appeared as caricatures of themselves after a filtering process that lost any detailed sense of their perspective. As I'm sure you can imagine, this project was not without its problems. All historians such as the American Michael Frisch developed the concept of shared authority, the idea being that academics must work with community organisations or individuals to share the development and interpretation of the interview and interviews. Thus Daniel Kerr, for example, whose pioneering work includes an oral history of homelessness in Cleveland, Ohio, argues that by broadening the interpretive group, more effective research is produced. In his view, participatory oral history can make for better scholarship. As you can imagine, a number of historians, oral historians, have problematised this viewpoint. For example, Joanna Burnett, who's argued that community histories can be empowering on the one hand, but they can also be exclusive and concealing on the other. Concealing tensions, for example, within communities around issues such as race, in the Northern Ireland context, religion. Whilst the brilliant historian of London, Jerry White, has argued that the personal stories that are at the forefront of oral history often neglect the wider structural forces and social relationships that shape people's lives, i.e. capitalism. And he argues that only the trained professional historian can offer the necessary analysis then in this world of oral history. Similarly, the Italian Luisa Passerini critiqued the facile democratisation and complacent populism of many oral history projects. Projects that encourage groups to speak for themselves but do not see how memories might be influenced by dominant histories and thus perhaps are lacking critical interpretation. Within Britain, developments included those advocated by the Popular Memory Group at the Centre for Contemporary Cultural Studies at Birmingham University, who highlighted the social production of memory and argued that the political struggles over the construction of the past are profoundly significant both in contemporary politics and for individual memory. Arguably, we just had a little bit of that in the last session. Now, Stephen Yeo argues that the process of community history making was political in itself. Developing people's skills to make their own histories was in itself a radical move. Process as well as product is political from this perspective. And moreover, the texture and detail of interviewees, of what they offered, was often complicated, simplistic analyses, which historians might be tempted to write without this oral evidence. So these are important points I want to return to in a few minutes in discussing the case study, which I'm going to give you, the Belfast Docklands, and in particular some of the community groups that have operated there. Okay. Let's talk a little bit first, though, about previous oral history highlights in terms of Northern Ireland. And obviously, I haven't got very much time here, so I'm just going to highlight one or two issues and particular points, I guess. I suppose many of you were familiar with some of the pioneering oral history work, such as work by Ronnie Monk and Bill Rolston, Belfast in the 1930s, which are amongst the first to really use oral history to analyse working class life and labour in the city of Belfast. More recent important work, I think, would include Anna Bryson's suggestive article based on interviewing in Maharaj, which is called Whatever You Say, Say Nothing, which really flags up the particular difficulties of interviewing here and particular subjectivities. You know, I have a second year oral history course, and one of the difficult questions that students have to ask in their interviews is, what are you? What's your religion? Listening to those interviews, it's often very interesting to hear the pauses from both sides of the interview as people start to weigh things up what's the nature of this actual exchange and how is it going to reflect and shape the whole interview. Bryson's work is interesting because it's about life in Mahara before the Troubles, and one of the things that she talks about is the extent to which memory post-Troubles, with memory being produced today of those events, is inevitably filtered through the prism of the Troubles. In her interpretation, there were two distinct communal narratives for Mahara. Her Protestant interviewees viewed the post-war period as a golden age of community relations. Stress was laid on Catholic attendance, for example, at Orange Hall dances. In contrast, interviews with Catholics frequently referenced private or public discrimination against their community, and this tended to produce stereotypical depictions of the Protestant community in the greater sense. They tended to break down when individual Catholics spoke about relationships with neighbours, and then the testimony becomes much more interesting, perhaps. Okay. And then I'm going to highlight some of those points, and I'm going to return to some of them when we have a look at our case study, but just to give you some examples of the kind of material that is out there. I can look at where the mouse is. The internet was working before the tea break. I was going to show you some of the material that's out there. There's a website called Northern Ireland Archives, which is a link to many kind of community history projects, many of them including oral history, which exists right across Northern Ireland. One of the points I wanted to make was that while that's a good repository, it's a good place to kind of start looking for oral history projects, quite often when you start to follow the links through, you tend to hit kind of dead ends and walls where the interviews are forthcoming and this is in progress, this is a work in progress. Obviously there are funding issues that are involved with that, which are problematic. Another issue I think that's involved in that is how many of the projects are very community specific, so there's not really, research being done or cognizance from one group to another about what messages were similar, what aspects of history are similar, what could they learn from each other. That's not necessarily taking place. I was also going to show you the accounts of the Troubles. I'm not talking necessarily about conflict resolution interviewing today, and one reason I'm not necessarily talking about that because it's not my kind of speciality. But also because the Stormont House Agreement has kind of, as I understand it, has kind of fenced that off. There will be an oral history element to the Stormont House Agreement, which is going to deal, kind of a mini version of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Whether or not that ever actually happens is another matter, but that's what's planned at the moment. But the INCOR website at the University of Ulster has lots of material which, is dealing with those issues already and has been collecting those issues for some time. I wanted to show you the East Side Community Heritage Project, which is a lotteries funding project in East London, which has been running since the 1990s, and that's, from my perspective, much more interesting. The breadth and range of the type of oral history that's being collected there, the way in which that oral history has been kind of explained rather than just sitting there on a website for kind of random access where people don't necessarily kind of know how to use it or isn't explained how you might use it. That's the kind of website that I would advocate kind of others modelling their own future plans on. Okay, so to say a little bit about myself as an oral historian and then talk a little bit about Sailor Town, the Docklands area of Belfast as a case study. I'm an oral historian as both a researcher and as a lecturer. I've been in Northern Ireland since 1999, but I'm still sort of very much aware that I'm a blow-in. I once interviewed a 97-year-old lady in Ardoyne who'd been in Ardoyne for 50 years and considered herself a blow-in who was distrusted by the Ardonians. you know, most of whom were younger than she was, you know. So I'm very conscious that I am a blow-in. So dealing with oral history here has always been interesting. I've always found particularly interesting is my name is Sean Patrick O'Connell, and I've got an English accent, so I can, you know, I can be equally suspect to everybody, really, or potentially at least. But my interests have been in interviewing people around the history of working class communities. I've been interested in a number of aspects of that, the involvement of credit unions, money lending, the Belfast Cooperative Society, family and community life, the Belfast hard man in social memory. And in each case, I think my understanding has been very much enriched by oral history, and new questions have arisen through my use of oral history. In terms of shared authority, I've also had my work critiqued by oral interviewees, which I found interesting. Some of you may have come across the late Terry O'Neill, who was a North Belfast kind of local historian, used to write in the Belfast magazine. He gave me some of his work. I gave him a copy of my book on the social history of the car, and he told me the week after I needed to put some more jokes in. It was too dry. So ever since then I've tried to kind of uplift and become less academic and dry, perhaps, in the way I approach my work. And more recently I've used oral history as a teaching method. Well, I first did that in the 1990s, but more recently here at Queen's. And what I want to talk about today is, in the case study, is the use of oral history in terms of a project on Sailor Town and the Dockland community of Belfast. So what did the oral history of this particular community reveal? Well, certainly it revealed the trauma experienced in that area, as well as in other large parts of the city, Shankill, Carrick Hill, as a result of the urban renewal of the 1970s and early 1980s. And certainly the interviews provided an antidote to the views of the Irish Times journalist, who in 1959 was expressing bewilderment at why residents of Carrick Hill were objecting to redevelopments that included tower blocks. From his perspective, what was wrong with living in these new places in the sky? They looked very good on the plans. So in the Sailor Town district, there were two groups which I've engaged with, which students engaged with: the Sailor Town Regeneration Group and a group called SHIP, Shared History Interpretive Project. They're both rightly, I think, suspicious of authority, including academic researchers, as a result of their experience of redevelopment, of deindustrialisation. And they've clearly been empowered, I think, by their community building, the roles that they've taken in writing and exploring their own community histories. They've rejected, I guess, the idea of Sailor Town as a slum. And they've also, in particular, in terms of the Sailor Town group, they've challenged the Catholic Church in its closure of St. Joseph. So they've both groups have been radicalised in various ways. I'll give you a sense here, the two illustrations, or a sense of the change in the community there. That's Nelson Street before and after redevelopment. So you can see the sense of John Campbell has written a book called Once There Was a Community Here, and you can see that's a very good image of that could reflect that sentiment. Okay, so what kind of things came from the interviews? What's particularly interesting, I'm only obviously have time to highlight certain aspects. In many ways, the interviews really produced a great flavour of the extent to which the culture at the docks, the workplace culture at the docks, was an alien culture to many other workers within the city. I'm going to give you hopefully a taste of that now with a quick illustration of it's self-explanatory, but this is as a worker from Shorts, spent most of his career in Shorts, but found himself working at the docks at one stage. It's an interesting example because it reflects perhaps many of the things we're going to be talking about today as well. So hopefully this is going to work. Again, it worked before the tea break.
A couple of boys up the chimneys, the sweep chimneys, we're putting them down the mines, so the unions have a part to play. But at the same time, the manager has got to be allowed to manage. Now, it's getting the balance right. That's the trick. That is the trick, getting the balance right. But I mean, the unions are necessary, but they in those days they weren't sufficiently held in check, and disputes were unbelievable. Surely, there was a big dispute one time. Called this meeting. I mean, he'd been working away there until get up to the main factory at dinner time. There's a meeting, and everybody was there, and Jimmy Graham. It's funny the name's coming back to me, Tony. He was a convener. And his sidekick, don't know his name, but his nickname was the Northern Duck. Because everything Jimmy Graham would do, he would not, and that was his nickname, the Northern Duck. But anyway, the strange things that come back to your mind. Jimmy Graham, anyway, said, "Right, lads, we're going up the road and we're not coming back to the get what we want." And I says, "Oh my God, you know, here we go again." And they walked out, and I had never been out of work. And I came home on a Friday night and I said to Chris, "You know, we're on strike, what do I want to do?" And I had in the course of conversation with a friend of mine found out about the Dockers, and I decided that I would have a go with this. You know, I didn't know anything about what I was going to do. I just knew where it was on Pilot Street. I had an old green suit and an old green cap, and I put it on, and I bought a copy of the Irish News because I was told that it was Catholic dominated. He was a Protestant, you know, and I had to go down and work with these people here, and I didn't know what was going to happen. But I made my way down anyway, and I found out very quickly the established Dockers had a brass badge. They had a badge, a button, and whenever work became available, they were forced, and there was no chance of ever becoming a Docker, because if a Docker died, the button passed to his son. It was a closed shop. But as well as these established Dockers, there was casual labourers, and if they wanted so many people to do a particular job, and there wasn't sufficient established Dockers, then they would call on the casual labourers. So that's you. I went down there in the hope that I would get a job as a casual labourer, and I presented myself at this big empty hangar it was, and there was men all standing around, and all smoking wee cigarette butts up against the walls, and I didn't know what was going to happen. So what do? You ask somebody. Big mistake. So I approached this. I picked out this individual who was sort of approachable, and I said to him, "What happens down here?" And he took a step back from me, and he looked me up and down and turned and walked away. He never spoke to me. You were on your own. So I just had to wait. And eventually, this well-dressed, portly man came in, sit on, and he was surrounded by probably union representatives of the world. And he said that he wanted so many. And you see these, he had a handful of buttons, and he just threw them into them. Everybody died. He learned very quickly. I didn't stand back. I wanted a button, and I got a button. And you know, I was stomped on, I got elbowed, I got kneed, maybe not deliberately, but in a general meaning, I got a button. And my mother didn't know what to do with it. So I just stood back until I seen other people with buttons, and they walked and I followed them. And when I got to it appeared to be the partial division I was in, and when I got to the thing.
Okay, I'm going to stop that there because I'm conscious of time. But what's interesting about that is the viewpoints of an outsider to that culture who's coming in from a very different workplace culture. And he goes on and he explains, you know, how his shock at the kind of work practices at the docks from his perspective, you know, extremely unusual, you know, sort of petty theft and kind of insubordination of various kinds and what have you, which kind of link very well with kind of Pat Eyre's understanding of and description of dock place culture and masculinity at the Liverpool docks, where people who are particularly powerless in their position as workers, you know, took power, if you like, or took power where they could, and took, celebrated a common masculinity, a common masculine status by petty theft, by pulling dodges, if you like, pulling strokes in the workplace, and also by the leisure culture which took place outside the workplace as well. So that's something that definitely comes through in the oral history interviews. What's also of Sailor Town, what also comes through is the very, almost you could say, hyper masculinity of the Dockers culture, again fitting in very well with the kind of understandings of other Dock cultures, such as this is by the artist Terry Bradley, who specialises in kind of Sailor Town artwork, and a lot of his artwork looks like this. And the community groups there have kind of also been active. I mean, this is I actually love these photographs that have been placed above the motorway that has now run through what was the area, and which are photographs of family groups. You can go down and have a look at those yourself. And what's interesting about this particular group, I think, from both sides of the community, both Catholics and Protestants, is that the Dockline community does have a labour history as well, which is also part of the history there, and it's that which is very rich within the social memory of the community there. It gives them an alternative, I suppose, discourse to the more mainstream, if you like, sectarian discourses which might exist in other areas, in other communities within Belfast. So again, this kind of this visual culture is very much reflected in the oral histories that were collected there as well. And perhaps because of that alternative, if you like, labour history, labour social memory, trade union social memory there, in the interviewees with Catholic residents there, there's not the same element, not the same reflection, I suppose, of the kind of points that Bryson was making about interviews with the Catholics of Mahara. Instead, there's very much a sense of a golden age. The Catholics of Sailor Town, in their broader overarching story, is a story of a golden age, and that may also be reflective, I suppose, of the fact that the community has disappeared. There might be elements of nostalgic memory perhaps working there as well. But you can perhaps have a look at these quotes for yourselves. It's John Clancy, another. He was you ever see the bookseller of Belfast? That's John Clancy, who was one of those interviewed for the project. Unfortunately, he's passed away recently. And the interviewees are not, without the knowledge of sectarianism. Sectarianism is very much a factor within the interviews as well, but it's perhaps not the crucial factor for these interviewees, at least. That's a longer quote with John Clancy explaining what happened to a Catholic man who came in and made a sectarian comment to a Protestant male in a bar that was dominated by Catholics, and his unceremonious ejection from the bar. At the same time, there are elements of what would be called nostalgia. It's nostalgic social memory. As we all know, in the working class past, when you go out and do your interviews, there's often a sense that there was no crime, didn't exist. In the same interview where somebody will be telling you about fights taking place in the street, or maybe later on they might be talking about petty theft at work. Okay, there's a final example there from Liam McGrin from Ships, who's again very much flagging up the kind of the labour history element of Sailor Town and the Docklands community. Okay, so moving forward then, what conclusions do I want to make? What's fascinating to me in doing oral history in Belfast, in Northern Ireland, is the extent to which there are lots of community groups out there that seem to me to be struggling to come to terms, trying to make sense of their past. And it's not just the past where conflict is at the forefront. They want to make sense of the past, which includes deindustrialisation or social change or social mobility or you know, what was our neighbourhood like in the past? And I don't think they're being well served at the moment by historians in that sense, and I don't think they have any resources really to use in that sense. What I'd like to see academic historians do is to engage in a project which moves towards the shared authority which I spoke about of the oral historian. Now, at the moment within Queen's University, there's kind of popular parlance is to talk about global institutes and global research questions, and to speak of leadership. Now, all of these things, I think, potentially set up Queen's University as a hierarchical institution with the potential to exclude local communities with which it coexists. My own hope would be for a potential for oral history which is much more democratic. And moreover, I would argue that in learning about the local, we could take lessons to apply to global discussions about narrative, about testimony, about memory. And all of these arise within particular circumstances of Northern Ireland. I think the last discussion we had about, you know, the 1968, 1969 indicate, you know, the fascinating ways in which memory itself is a wonderful topic. So I'd like to open up the discussion in a number of ways, to ask how the audience, this audience, feels about the relationship between academics, community groups, trade unionists, particularly ask a number of questions. How can we move forward to employ new digital technology to provide powerful historical resources? What are the ethics surrounding going digital and how can we tackle them? How can we exploit fully the potential of the web? What else can sit alongside interviews? What other things could we put alongside the oral history interviews? Photographs is something that we're making a kind of a side theme of today, but it could be very much central to what we did in a kind of an internet resource for working class history. And how can we develop processes that are engaging and empowering rather than exploitative of the groups which academics seek to work with? My own view is that we should not let oral history retreat into dry, arcane academic debates about the interpretation of memory. Instead, it should be informed by active and continuing engagement with interviewees. And doing this may enable us to engage oral history in political